Hey everybody, it's Adam, live and in person for you. Hey everybody, it's Adam, wonder who he'll interview.
Hey everyone, it's Call Me Adam. Welcome to season 2 of my podcast, Bearing It All with Call Me Adam. This season, we are focusing on my guests' legacies and lessons learned, as well as some other fun topics I hope you'll enjoy. On today's episode of Bearing It All with Call Me Adam, I am chatting with theater royalty and SAG Award winner for Netflix's Orange is the New Black, Annie Golden. Annie may have been mute behind bars, but was going to talk with me about her legacy in part one of our interview. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Congratulations on season 2.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Well, we have so much to talk about, so why don't we get started?
Yes.
Okay. So let's start with one of my new topics is all about legacy. So in like X amount of years from now, when someone mentions Annie Golden, what do you hope they say about you?
That old thing? No. I gave this some thought, and I think it's just from the beginning of my career, from the very start, I would walk into a casting session or, you know, recording session or an interview, an audition, and people would say, Annie Golden. Yeah, that's your stage name. What's your real name? And it actually is my real name. So it is my family name. So I feel like when people say my name, I think it just infers kind of I was named correctly, Annie Golden. It should be laughter and light, and that's what I hope it will evoke when people mention my name, you know, in the future.
Well, you certainly do bring a lot of laughter and light in all the work you do.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And a lot of people know, but in case for some of my listeners who may not, you got your start when you fronted the punk band, The Shirts.
Yes.
So why are you so proud to have this band as part of your history and that time in music?
Well, it was, you know, it was late 70s, throughout the 80s on the Bowery at CBGB's. And I liken it to Liverpool with the Beatles, the Cavern Club. I mean, it suddenly was a scene, but when you're in it, you don't really know that it's going to be important in the future, that it's going to be part of New York history, music history. And so, you know, I'm so happy to be a part of that. And it was really, I just recently saw a documentary called The Comedy Store about the comedians on the Sunset Strip. And, you know, they had David Letterman and Richard Pryor and, you know, Jim Carrey. And they showed footage of people when they were starting out. And I just thought, that's similar to the scene that we went to. They were saying, you know, they would go on at 1:45 to a.m. to 7 people to do new material. We called it at CBGB's on the Bowery, the graveyard shift. So then you could do, yeah, and we would go on at like 1 a.m. on a school night, on a weeknight. You know, that's how young we were, on a school night.
Oh my God.
But so it who knew when we were in it? But, you know, the Talking Heads, David Byrne, the Ramones, Blondie, all of those bands we played with and we hung with and, you know, and it actually was a part of history. But when you're in it, you don't know. You're just excited. Yeah, you're just excited to, you know, to be a part. And that's why that's why I'm so proud to have it part of my legacy. And that's where I was discovered by Milos Forman. So the stars aligned, you know, and here it is 40 years later, and I'm still doing the career that he gave me.
That's incredible. You're very, very lucky.
I totally am. I mean, I refer to CBGB's as my Schwab's drugstore, because back in the golden age of Hollywood in the 40s, Lana Turner was discovered at the counter of Schwab's drugstore. So CBGB's is my Schwab's drugstore, where I was discovered CBGB's fronting a band.
And here we are, like you said, 40 years later, and your body of work is magnificent. I mean, from Broadway to off-Broadway to film to TV, you have done it all.
I have been very lucky, yeah.
Yes. What shows are you most proud of to have in your body of work?
Before we get to that answer, let's take a quick break and get a word in from one of our sponsors. We'll be back in a minute. Oh, wait. You don't know? You haven't heard? You must not be subscribed to the Call Me Adam Digest. When you sign up for the Call Me Adam Digest, you are the first to know. You get a front row seat to my interviews and podcast episodes, where you get to discover new things about your favorite celebrities. You get personal stories from the other side of the microphone that you wouldn't know by just reading, watching, or listening to my interviews. We get to have a weekly connection, and you can add some fun to your weekend. So come take a peek behind the curtain with the Call Me Adam Digest. Sign up today at callmeadam.com. Can't wait to see you there. Welcome back to Burying It All with Call Me Adam. So as you were saying...
Well, I guess I would say what I'm most proud of in my career would probably be the roles that I originated. Mm-hmm. You know, like Georgi Bukatinsky in The Full Monty, and Squeaky Fromm in Assassins. And also, you never know, again, you never know. You're just living your life. You hope to get the gig. You want to get a paycheck. If it's a good gig, you want to get it. If it's a reputable person, you want to work with them. And I mean, now part of my legacy is that I'm a Sondheimian leading lady. You know, who yes. knew? But of course, if Sondheim was ever going to write a role for a soprano and cast me, she should be called Squeaky. So, you know, so yes. there's that.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I loved you in Athens.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was the hottest ticket in town. So those are the roles that I'm most proud of, I think, is and then Georgi Bukatinsky in The Full Monty.
Yes.
I remember being in my living room, and I got to tell Terrence McNally this story, that I was watching him on late night television being interviewed about Masterclass, and he was talking about his love of Maria Callas, and I was going, I like this guy. I want to, you know, this guy is passionate. I'd like to work with that guy someday, you know, and that was before anything, you know. So
wow.
I got to tell him that, because I kind of liked that he was saying she's an opera diva, but she was not perfect. She was not perfection, but she was passionate. And I was like, oh, I like that. The quirky opera singer. This guy loves her. Okay, great. I'm down with this guy, Terrence McNally.
Yes. So you pretty much manifested your getting cast in Full Monty then.
I guess I did. I mean, I'm a good witch. I'm a good witch. Yeah.
Oh, I loved you in Full Monty. That was the show that you and I met. I mean, I can't believe it's been that long that we've known each other.
Yes, we recently did a reunion on Zoom during the pandemic. Yes. Jason Danieli got us all together, and Jack O'Brien was there, and Lindsay Law was there, and Jerry Butler, and Patrick Wilson, and John Ellison Conley, and everybody was there, and it was just wonderful to see everybody, and see everybody still doing it and going strong, and yeah, it's great.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Yeah. Are there any shows you wish you could remove from your legacy of work?
Isn't that funny that you say that? Because I was like, wait, what? Remove? Because my mission statement is, you know, like my name, Annie Golden, Golden Annie, Golden Girl. My mission statement is to just, you know, delight, you know, and entertain. And so to my mission statement is every time I do a gig, I get a BFF out of it. Like whatever, however challenging the gig was, whatever the issues were. And that would be mostly regional stuff when I have to go away, which Dolly will never go away again. No, I'm not going away anymore. But anyway, you know, regional gigs when you're not in your wheelhouse and you don't have your support system and your family. And I mean, I was doing regional gigs when we didn't have Zoom, we didn't have phones, we didn't have FaceTime. So you were really, you didn't see your family, you didn't see your friends for however long that may be. I would say remove from my resume only because the resume, thank God, is ongoing. Mm-hmm. So things become, and also particularly it's different for girls. You're only as good as your most recent credit. And since you have more impressive credits as you continue, hopefully, then you're not sitting back on your laurels. You don't need the old stuff and you don't need the out of town stuff. But I would never really remove anything because I have forever friends. You know, I started it with when I went to Colorado. I did a sit down with the John Denver musical, Almost Heaven. And I bonded with my dear friend Marsh Hansen, whom I didn't know in New York. And he was in Les Mis, and you know, we never met in New York. And then we bonded like crazy in Colorado, and we clung to each other. So every job after that, I would say, who's my Marsh? I called him Handsome. Who's my Handsome? So I would always come off of a gig with a new friend, didn't have to be a guy. And I would say, you know, you're my Marsh from this gig. You're my BFF from this gig. So just removing things is just when you bump it up with something more recent. That's what I would do. Otherwise, I try to enjoy everything I do. So I wouldn't really remove anything. I haven't had any nightmares that have to be removed. So that's great. Oh.
That's good. That's good. And you have such a positive outlook and a wonderful, I love your mission statement and I love how you look at every single job and opportunity. And I just think that's so fantastic.
Well, it's kind of like people say, how do you keep a show fresh? And we had done the full Monty for, you know, 2 years. We had done it during 9/11. How do you keep it fresh if you're doing 8 shows a week? And I'm kind of like, well, every time you do a new job, you're open to new creatives, new production companies, you know. So that's your attitude, is when you go out and you've been doing it for 2 years and there's a new audience, you're like, there's somebody new out there to impress. There's somebody new out there to inspire. So with that mindset, nothing, you know, everything is an opportunity to improve. And challenge yourself and nourish yourself with new creatives or new people. So, yeah. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
I think that's a great story to stick to. And I think a lot of people can learn from that outlook.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just take it off if it's old and out of town.
Yes.
And then, you know, don't, you know, and then people will find out. I mean, people will be like, wait, you did a workshop of Carrie, the musical? What was that like? You know, so.
Yes.
So you have secrets. You have secrets to delight people, you know.
Yes, yes. And I love learning about everybody's secrets. So we'll find out some of yours, maybe.
Maybe.
maybe. How do you hope your work on Orange is the New Black fits into your, you know, your legacy? When people think about what you did on that show, what's like the one thing you want someone to be like, wow, she did that on the show really good?
Well, it was kind of funny that When I auditioned for it, I auditioned for Sister Ingalls, the Beth Fowler role.
Oh, yes.
And yeah. And then Genji contacted my agents and said she was offering me Norma Romano. And we were all like, who's Norma? Because there's no breakdown and there's no sides. And, you know, and the reason was Genji was going to write it. And I did not know that my character was a traumatic mute at the time. Mm. I was maybe the first silent cat. Well, there was a movie, Jane Wyman, in the 50s called Johnny Belinda. She was also a traumatic mute. So, but it was something new, and it was specific to my character. So if it was a device, I'm going to ride on that wave of, you know, just listening and being still, which is the kind of actress that I am anyway. So I'm so glad that Genji Cohen, you know, tapped into that. But also, when we would, House of Cards started on Netflix. Mm-hmm. But when we started our second season, I remember our debut. And nobody knew who we were. And then our second season, when we had our premiere, the executive from Netflix came and invited everybody, welcomed everybody and said, "Welcome to the show that has put Netflix on the map." So, wow. I mean, that's really, and she would say that always. So mm-hmm. we were so excited to be that important. It gave attention to the problem of the incarcerated mm-hmm. in this country, women of color, single mothers. It was really just groundbreaking, and I'm so happy to be a part of it. And it was, you know, based on Piper's, you know, memoir, Orange mm-hmm. is the New Black. So it, Piper Kerman turned us all on to Women's Prison Association. These women were disenfranchised for decades. So Women's Prison Association is one of all of our new charities because, they don't get anything new. They get hand-me-downs. So, you know, in a Broadway show, you get your underwear, your names in your underwear. You get extra so that, you know, your costumes, you get extra. So we would, at the end of a show, whether it be Broadway or off-Broadway, we would take all our stuff over to Williams Women's Prison Association so that they would have stuff to wear to job fairs, job interviews, parole hearings, family court to get their children back. So it was really very satisfying on a lot of levels. Orange is the New Black. And then let's not even talk about that ensemble that I got to work with.
Yes.
With most of those women being theater people. I mean, you know, Leah Delaria and I were, you know, we did On the Town with George yes. C. Wool. So we were like this, you know, and other people, Elizabeth Rodriguez, all these theater people, Beth Fowler, it just, you know, it was just heady stuff and so fun and exciting.
Yes. Well, I loved you on the show. And I know, I mean, I'm sure everybody listening loved you on that show. Now, another big show that you did, you've actually had several different incarnations with is Hair, because you were in the
yes.
film, you were in the Broadway revival. So can you talk to us a little bit about why the show is so important to you and why you love doing it?
Well, it's actually like right in my wheelhouse, you know, love and light, you know, so it's kind of in my wheelhouse. And it's so funny because I came from the punk scene, which is so like, you know, hardcore and, you know, and me going, la, 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 you know, like just like the flower child who will not wilt. That's me.
Yes.
So, so I have to thank Hilly Crystal at CBGB's because, you know, as I said, that was where I was discovered. I told the Terrence McNally story, but I also had a story that I told Milos Forman when we became friends. I was sitting, I guess, in my parents' house when I was watching the Oscars and Milos picked up his Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And his date was his twin boys who were about 12 or 14 at the time. And I said, that guy, he walked the red carpet. And I went, that guy's brought his kids. I said, I love that guy. So it's so funny how, you know, stuff resonates to you. And then if you're, you know, as lucky as I am, you get to meet these people. So Hilly Kristal and CBGB's Milos Forman discovered me there. He was talent scouting or slumming, depending on how you look at it. And he came down to CBGB several times, and he picked several other people to audition. He was looking for fresh new talent, which they don't really do anymore. And he put me in the movie, and to this day, we just had our 40th reunion of the tribe of the film. The film cast.
Oh, wow.
There was we lost Milos in April of last year. And so, not last year, 2 years ago. And so he was on the board of the Avon Theater, and they were renovating this beautiful Art Deco theater in Connecticut. And they did a screening of Hair. They sold tickets. It was a fundraiser. They got us all together. They put us up. It was John Savage, Treat Williams, Beverly D'Angelo, Donnie Dacus, and Dorsey Wright, and we were all together, and I keep in touch because that's me, but they actually, you know, we hadn't been together in the same room for 40 years.
Wow.
So that was lovely. Yeah. And I was on a movie set, but it was in Central Park, which was where I would hang. So it was an amazing situation to be in the film and to have the genie character be mine cinematically. And it was kind of a publicity. I was the start of stunt casting too, I guess, because I didn't have any credits. I didn't, you know, I was just a kid from a rock band on the Bowery. And I was a sponge. I just listened. I just listened and learned and absorbed everything. And Twyla Tharp was the choreographer. And then I started doing, I know. And so it was stunt casting. So I got my Equity card and my Screen Actors Guild card, both thanks to Milos Forman, because then I was suddenly on the casting list. And they said, they're considering, this girl for Genie. Let's bring her in. Mark Shaiman played my audition for Jim Rado and Jerry Radney and Galt McDermott, because they were going to mount a revival of Hair as a publicity, you know, to gain attention for the movie beginning to shoot on location in New York. So I went in, and that's how I met Mark. Mark was sitting at the piano, and I didn't know what to sing. And I was like, they go, well, you're in a band, you know, do you write songs? I said, no, really, the boys write the songs. I don't read music, so I didn't bring anything. I don't know what to sing. And I had Judy Garland's biography by Gerald Frank in my hand. And Mark saw it. And he said, what you got there? What are you reading? And I said, oh, Judy Garland. He goes, oh, and he started tickling the ivories with Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And I'm always chasing rainbows. And so he started playing. He said, you know this one, right? And I started singing. And then he went, can you do it here? Can you sing it there? So Mark Shaiman got me got me further along on my audition process. So it was the revival at the Biltmore Theater, directed by the original director, Tom O'Horgan. So I hit it just at the time I got to be with Jerry and Jimmy. Jerry died shortly after that, Jerome Radney. And I'm still close with Jim Rado to this day, and Galt McDermott. And so they always drag this whole thing out when they're doing something that has to do with Hair. And then in Orange, one of the original run genies, Dale Soles, was Frieda Berlin. So we always talk about that we're the two genies.
Oh my God.
I know.
Such a connect. It has like stayed with you literally throughout your whole career. That is so amazing.
So amazing. And, absolutely wonderful.
Yes. Yes. Well, my last.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no. What were you going to say?
I said, you can't make this stuff up.
No. No, not at all. Not at all.
It's just my life. It writes itself.
Yes. Yes. I mean, yeah. you've been truly blessed. It's so beautiful to see.
Absolutely. And don't I know it? Yeah.
Yes. And my last question in the legacy portion is, what's something about you that you would like to get passed on to the children of your family, like your nieces and your nephews? What's something you want them to always remember or know about you?
Well, not to beat a dead horse, you know, but the element of joy, you know, to bring joy, to give joy, to spread joy. As a matter of fact, when I was being considered to play Squeaky Fromm in Assassins, and that was ages ago, I was still young, you're still building your resume, I was like, I want my legacy to be Jeannie. I want my legacy to be from that era, the loving peace and love girl. I don't know if I want to do the other side of the coin with the misguided zealot of the groupie, you know, the redheaded homicidal, you know. So right. I was torn, but then I went in and, you know, sang for Stephen Sondheim. And as long as Stephen wanted me, I was like, sure, you know, not going to pass up this opportunity. I'm not that stupid. But I would say just, you know, I mean, I guess it's typecasting then. It's just try to make everything you do love and light, you know, just try to impart, but in not in a bobblehead way, just in an organic, authentic way. Just try to, if people are gossiping or if people are being naysayers, which is harder and harder in this climate. I'm just glad that on election day, you know, that was a Tuesday, but we didn't know until Saturday that our prayers had been answered. And yes. I feel like, you know, the next day, the world was a little less ugly, you know? So that's, you know, that's what I would try to impart to the kids is just, you know, enjoy everything you do. And don't waste any moments with, you know, with negativity or competitiveness or, you know, which, you know, our whole atmosphere lately has been that. And
yes.
I see the clouds breaking and the sun shining through because it was really wearing me down, you know.
Yes.
So really,
yes. No, me too.
Yeah. So it's really that. I mean, I just try to make, when I would do a master class, I was at the Einhorn School for the Performing Arts, doing a master class at primary stages. And I would say, when you walk into the audition room, to take the pressure off yourself of being chosen, choose me. I have 8 minutes to make you want to pick me. Just say, make their day. Walk in and make their day. That's your objective. To accomplish what you want to accomplish, maybe with a new song or singing your song the best you can, or trying not to look at the paper when they've given you the sides for a cold read or something. You know, just make their day. And if they're on the phone while you're auditioning, or they're eating their salad while you're auditioning, maybe you don't want to work with them. You know what I mean? So
yes.
Try to,
yes.
Yeah, that's so even not even just, you know, silly, you know, hippie-ish joy, but just be a bright light wherever you can, you know, Gandhi said that first. So
that's beautiful. Yeah.
But you know, that's really what I would impart.
That's wonderful. And that's such great advice for actors, especially as auditions are starting to open up again, whether over Zoom or whatnot. That's great to let future actors now know how to handle a room.
Yes. And they also, I mean, the kids coming up now, I mean, it started as early as the Full Monty with me, where I was in a rehearsal, you know, with Patrick Wilson, Emily Skinner. I mean, these kids went to Carnegie Mellon. I didn't know what that was. Then when I was in the hair revival, in 1977, summer of 77, we were rehearsing it. I was with Peter Gallagher, and I was with David Patrick Kelly. And I mean, those people, they studied, and I didn't study. I didn't have any training, formal training. As I said, I was just a sponge. So, I mean, as early as that, I was, you know, as early as the Full Monty, I was saying to people, these kids are triple threats. They come out of performing arts programs and they can read. They can sing anything. They can dance. They can act a scene. You know, so I wasn't intimidated because by then I had had experience and I knew what I was doing. But I just went, you know, nobody falters. Nothing is uncertain. Everything is just, you know, they got this. And that's not true. That's not true. Because, you know, a creative person is always going to want to do their best and don't know if they have done their best. But it was just these kids are trained within an inch of their lives and they're so capable. So when you walk in, you know, be that bright light.
Yes.
It's so wonderful.
So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll do some rapid fire questions and find out even more about Annie. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Annie Golden.
Growing up as a latchkey kid in a small town in Maine, I always assumed I was safe. After all, unless it makes national news, murder isn't something people talk about around here. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Murder, She Told is a true crime podcast featuring crime stories, unsolved murders and missing persons, and baffling cold cases from my home state of Maine, New England, and small towns across America. These are the crime stories your hometown doesn't want to talk about, the mysteries buried deep in the newspaper archives of local American history. These are the homicides you've probably never heard of before. Through detailed storytelling and connections with family, friends, and investigators closest to the case, Murder, She Told will hit home for any true crime fan, whether you're from Maine or from away. Visit murdershetold.com to suggest your hometown crime story and subscribe now wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm Kristen Seavey, and this is Murder, She Told.
Hey, everyone. This is Annie Golden, and you're listening to Bearing It All with Call Me Adam.
And now we're back.
Yay.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Adam.
You're welcome. Let's do some rapid fire questions. Let's start with favorite TV show.
Law and Order franchise or because the New York actors would make television are making television money. Or maybe because it's longevity, Law and Order, it's been around forever. So,
I love
that.
Yeah. I love SVU. One of my favorite. Yep.
Oh, my God. Who knew that it was going to, like, surpass the original, really?
I know.
Yeah.
Historic.
Or if you want comedy, Saturday Night Live, if you want comedy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Favorite musical?
Little Shop of Horrors.
I love it.
I was the last Audrey that Howard Ashman put in the original.
Oh my God.
In the original run down at the Orpheum where Stomp is. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I got to work with Howard. And also I just recently saw the movie. And when does someone who originated a role, particularly with the girls, Ellen Green, get to see it through? See it through.
Yes.
So Little Shop of Horrors. I mean, that score is so clever and wonderful, and it's kind of my wheelhouse because it's pop Broadway, you know. So
yes.
Little Shop of Horrors. I love
one of my favorite musicals as well.
Yes.
Favorite play?
Our Town by Thornton Wilder. Does anyone realize life as they live it, every minute? So that's. That's the quote.
Yes. Favorite cereal?
Raisin Bran.
Yes. Favorite game show?
I don't really watch game shows, but was there one called Concentration with Hugh Downs back in the, this is before your time, but
Yeah.
I used to like that because people would call things, and it was so in the beginning, it was the setup where you would just turn the board around, and then you would get to see where everything is placed, and then you would have to remember it. So concentration with Hugh Downs.
Love it. Favorite board game?
Scrabble, because it's language and it's words. And they have Scrabble Junior. So it's, you know, we don't have language much anymore because we text and we do abbreviations and we do, you know, so Scrabble with language. Yeah.
Yeah. Your go-to karaoke song?
Harry Nilsson's Can't Live.
If
living is without you.
Got you. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Love that song.
Yeah. That song is money. And
yes. And Mariah Carey does a great version that I love of it as well.
Yes, she does. And it's, you know, and I like it for karaoke because it starts really simple and as you would say in, you know, singer's lingo, intimate and cabaret. And then it just is epic and operatic. So Can't Live.
Yes.
Yeah.
And lastly, your go-to emoji when texting.
This is so typical. It's thumbs up. You know what
Yes. Positivity.
Just thumbs up. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, we are unfortunately out of time for today's episode. Part 2 of my interview with Annie Golden will be coming soon, where we discuss lessons learned. So stay tuned.
He'll get the dirt and the scoop and the story, for he happens to be in the know. Just ask anybody who's Adam. Adam lives for the business of show. Callmeadam.com.